Today, it's a Monday. So I took Cora to school. I was at home with Oliver. We had fish tacos for supper. That's one of Cora's favorites.
Sweet.
So we made some flour tortillas and we were cooking ling cod. Do you like ling cod?
Yeah, I like ling cod.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I don't like it as much as like sablefish or...
Come on. You pay for sablefish?
Well, no, not very often. Kind of sucks how expensive it is.
Ling cod is like... Well, to be honest, I would say in terms of like quality and moisture retention and stuff, like it's at least as good as sablefish and it's much cheaper.
Right. It just isn't as fatty as sablefish, I find.
We should do a side-by-side.
Let's do it.
Next episode.
Next episode, sablefish, ling cod, black cod. Which one will win?
Wait, sablefish is black cod, right? Or no?
That's right.
Okay, good.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was like a three-way all of a sudden. I didn't understand.
No, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, I made that very confusing. Let's see. What did I have today? Not much. I just like bits and pieces and snacks and things. I didn't have too many. Oh, well, actually, that's not entirely true. I had a HelloFresh meal for dinner.
Oh, yeah.
I accidentally forgot to cancel HelloFresh this week. And, well, you know what that means.
How often has that happened? That's not the first time you've said that.
Yeah, I think it's happened 3 times.
It's kind of like, okay, tell me if this is a fair comparison or not.
Okay.
Like... There used to be credit card promotions where it's like, get on board with our credit card and there's no interest for the first 2 months and
right,
cancel anytime. But the thing is that like 80% of people forget to cancel it and then end up paying a huge amount of interest. Isn't that kind of what HelloFresh does or no?
Yeah, in a way. It's like any subscription service.
Yeah.
Like every subscription service preys on people who don't use the service as much as they think they're going to and don't have the capacity to manage the subscriptions in such a way that it doesn't cost them extra money. Mm-hmm. You know? And I don't know, if you're subscribing for things and you think that you're immune to that effect, then you're like a subscription services, like, they're whales, you know, like,
right.
You know what I mean by whale?
Like they're white whale, like they're Ahab and you're their
sort of
whale.
Like
they're after
whales,
you.
But what's that?
They're after you and they make the most of their money from you. Is that what
yeah,
you
mean? Yeah. Yeah. I don't think the analogy like comes directly from Moby Dick.
You're
but,
a good haul.
But yeah, whales in gaming and in like gambling and stuff, it's like a term for the sort of like juiciest patrons that are going to drop the most amount of money.
Right. Okay.
You know? And so in terms of people that are like setting up subscription services, like people who forget that they're subscribed to things are right. Those people's whales.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know, I subscribe to a lot of things and I understand about myself that I'm not that great at managing that. Mm-hmm. And so I do have to, like, I understand that going in and I do have to be somewhat careful about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sometimes I slip up. But it's like in the case of HelloFresh.
You still get delicious food.
You still get 3 meals. So, you know, like.
Use promo code FOODCORT. Is it worth the price? Like,
I mean, it kind of sucks, but I was going to buy groceries anyways. And then, you know, now I don't need to. So it's, you know, it's not the end of the world. I would prefer if I didn't forget to cancel when I don't need it. But, and they don't have a very good system for letting you do that. I mean, on purpose, obviously, you know, like if I could just, and I tried, like they used to have a system where you could tell them that you only wanted a meal every 2 weeks, but there's something broken about it. And like, I canceled a couple, and then I like asked them to put, like, when I first started, I was just canceling every second week. And then I tried to change my schedule so that I would only receive one every second week. And something happened because I had canceled a couple, and because I, you know, asked them to put me on a 2 week schedule where I just didn't receive one for like 3 months. And I had to call them like three times and be like, I'm not receiving my meals. And they're like, yes, you are. And I'm like, no, I'm not. So that was dumb, but
R2,
so now I realize that now I have to cancel them manually, but you know, sometimes I forget. I try to stay ahead of it. I have like a weekly reminder to go in and like check the next like 4 weeks to make sure that I have it all mapped out properly, but mm-hmm. This one slipped by me. So we had steak for dinner.
Bummer.
Steak frites with a kale Caesar salad. It was pretty good.
Steak frites.
Yeah, well.
Tell me about the frites. I want to know.
Okay, I will. Firstly, they're cooked in a convection oven, so that makes them air frited. I had to cook them in my air fryer.
Do you have an air fryer? So don't answer that.
Yes, I do, actually, Alan.
Do you mean your
came
convection?
With my house? Oh, it's okay, yeah. What's that? It's
you mean
it's
your convection
built oven? In? It's built into the stove thing. You just turn it on and preheat it to like 425 degrees, and then you just air fry stuff all day.
One of the ways, in the class that I teach at culinary school. There's not very many, there's no written exam or anything, but they do have to submit things like menus and recipes, and it be like it's a post-secondary and it's written work. And so the expectation is that it's original and it's not plagiarized.
That's fair.
And so
it's a fair expectation.
One of the, just anyone out there, if you are working in a commercial kitchen and certainly in the kitchens that we have at NEAT, if your recipe calls for the food to be put into the air fryer, then I know that you just took it from the internet because there's no air fryer in the kitchen I need.
Wah, wah. To be fair, maybe they meant the combi oven.
Yeah. It could be.
Maybe, well, like you maybe said, that's just the maybe that's the vernacular with the kids now for combi oven is air fryer.
That's true. You said that that's kind of the way that like kitchen language or sorry that like popular language is kind of manipulated by that kind of marketing, right? So it
exactly
sense. Yeah,
like in 20 years nobody's going to know what an oven is, Alan. No yeah. One will need to. Everyone will just have an air fryer.
Well, now that makes me wonder, like, hold on. Should we just stick with the baked French fries? Or are we going to do this? Do I mean, okay. Cause I'm thinking about my grandma's house, even mm-hmm. when I was little, which was not so long ago, but kind of a long time ago, like my grandma had a wood oven in her home. And every morning my grandaunt like fired up the wood oven. And so they called it I'd be curious to know all of the like specifics of the language they used to describe that machine. Cause it certainly was wood fired. It had an oven component, but it also had a stovetop component that was mm-hmm. heated by the same heat source. And it had the warming cabinet above.
Had a warming cabinet above.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It's kind of like, which is basically just like an oven that's a little bit farther down the thermal line. Like, it, do you know what I mean? Like
yeah. So like it like, so the wood stove exhausts out the top of the house probably, or out the back, but then the warming cabinet is what? Like it just like further up that exhaust pipe and some of the
exactly.
warm air from the oven. Yeah.
Huh? Yeah.
That's interesting.
Exactly. In fact, this is a weird thing to bring up. My mom has told me that some of her, oh my goodness, I think it was one of her aunts when like she was born in a farmhouse.
So your granddad, like the lady that stuffed the stove full of wood.
Sorry, say that again.
Your mom's aunt would be your granddad.
My mom's aunt. Yes, I agree with that statement.
Okay, good.
that we're getting, this is so far beyond the French fries that we were talking about.
We'll get back to the French fries, don't worry.
The little warming cabinet at the top of the wood oven, like at that time when my grandparents were born, most births happened at home. This was in rural locations, and so they weren't taken to the hospital. And one of my grandaunts was born premature or very small, and they kept her in that warming cabinet, like as a kind of incubator.
Wow, really?
Yeah, for real. Like I'm sure they sort of knew what they were doing, but it was like,
yeah. That's crazy. Maybe the mechanics of it aren't exactly how I pictured it in my head then, because like there would be the potential, I feel like, for smoke to get in there for oxygen to get sucked out if it wasn't ventilated properly and stuff. It seems extremely dangerous, but yeah.
This is definitely something that, I mean, every other episode we say something and then our mothers weigh in afterwards, so
it's happening again.
If I've misrepresented, that's my recollection of what was told to me, just that one of my mom's aunts, that when she was an infant, that was what happened. But
yeah, I mean, so it makes sense.
Yeah,
but it would also make sense to like
warm a blanket,
use a hot water bottle for that situation. So
I don't know. It would have been in the 20s or 30s or something, so I don't know.
Yeah, they had hot water bottles back then.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. It's interesting. Anyways, yeah, the frites were a chopped up russet potato that I cooked in the oven.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're actually decent. I mean, you know, they weren't French fries, but...
That's what I was going to say. They sound like they could be good, but that doesn't sound like a French fry.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Shale.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. What do we got, Alan? Follow-up? We got follow-up from our previous episode?
It's all we have. Okay.
It's true.
Here's some follow-up.
Okay.
On the subject of gadgets.
Okay, let's hear it.
We were talking, we had received some gadget related feedback from Judy, right?
Yep. Man, people are passionate about gadgets. I love it. We're gonna have to do another gadget episode, obviously.
Yes, exactly. Judy actually brought some gadgets to my home for me to try.
Cool. Yeah. She emailed us and said she was going to bring you a garlic press. Did that happen?
She actually brought me two styles of garlic press.
Wait, there's two styles of garlic press?
There should only be one. I'll say that off the top. The style that most people are familiar with, I think, is, I'm holding this up for you, Shale, but I know people can't see it, but like this style, right? Like the lever style. It's like a,
yeah. So it looks kind of like a wrench, and it has like a little plunger that goes into a pocket where you put your garlic clove. And then that pocket has holes on the underside of it.
Yeah.
And you squeeze down on the handle and then it pushes the clove of garlic through the little holes and turns it into pulp.
Exactly. Yes.
Much to Anthony Bourdain's chagrin.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that's one style, the much, much more common style. And there's this style.
And okay.
You're going to take this a crack at it.
This looks like a, it kind of looks like a piece was cut out of the small side of a box grater and then mounted in like kind of a, like in an arc. Yeah. And it looks like, and it's got a handle connected to it, and it looks like you would put your garlic on the cutting board and then smush down on it and go back and forth and push it through like the holes of the piece of box grater, or it kind of looks like maybe like a piece of a microplane or something.
That's a very good description. That's more or less what I would say too, is like, it reminds me of the holes of a box grater, except that they are flush, like the perforations are flush with the steel. So there's no offset where a grater would have to like grab onto the food. And yeah, it's curved and mounted to a handle. So you rock it back and forth like the Mezzaluna that we were talking about one or two conversations ago.
Right.
Okay. So the like lever style, the like second class lever one that everyone's familiar with, like the plunger and basket.
When you say second class, you're talking about a an actual mechanical term for the description of the type of lever that it is, not that it's like, type of,
okay. That's true. Like, it's not like first, well, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Like,
okay.
Yeah. I didn't think about that. it's quite effective. There is still waste, obviously, with the design. Like there, but it seems like whether you put one clove or 100 cloves of garlic through that garlic press, there's going to be more or less the same amount of waste. It's just whatever is caught up in the perforations that can't quite get through.
Right.
And it's very easy. Like, you have very good mechanical advantage. It's very easy to use.
Right. And seems very quick as well.
Yep, totally. And we had wondered about, or had talked briefly about, like it being a pain to clean, but having used it over the last week with the right brush, and also the it comes with a little press with little pegs that are arrayed to fit perfectly through the perforations in the basket. Like it's actually quite easy to clean. So if you use it, well, I mean, what, it doesn't matter. Whatever. It works just fine. So if you find it useful, that's great. Mm-hmm.
Did you try it with the garlic in the skins and out of the skins?
Oh, no, I didn't know that you could do it with the skins, because
apparently you can put a clove of garlic in it with the skin on and it just works the same way. And then you just pull the skin out after.
Okay. Well, I've got it for another week, so I'll try that.
Oh, phew.
No, I've never heard of that. And the reason that I didn't even cross my mind, because as we discussed last time, I have that rubber mat garlic peeler now.
Oh, right. So it's so easy to peel your garlic. Why would you even?
I'll go to bat for it again. Like, it's actually shockingly effective. It's
okay.
It's lightning quick and there's no residual peel. I'm actually flabbergasted.
That's fancy.
It works really well. Yeah.
Have you washed it yet?
Yeah, just chuck it in the dishwasher.
Boom.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, but we have to talk about this travesty here. The arced, I have the actual box that it came in, but it's called the curved garlic press.
Okay.
So the rocking back and forth, like bent cheese grater kind of thing, this is an abomination, and it doesn't work. It's just one of those things.
Right. What I was going to say is it looks like it's not even strong enough to really, you know, like it looks like it would probably cave in after like, you know, 30 uses or something. Oh.
It's funny you say that. On the side of the box that it came in, on the side of the curved garlic press box,
says good for 30 uses only.
It says, like, this is supposed to be, I imagine it's supposed to be like, these are the things that you can expect from this mechanism, and like, this is why you should be proud of what you just purchased. It says curved garlic press, stainless steel fabrication, easy to damage, easy to deform.
Be careful with this. Don't put too much garlic now.
It's weird. Okay, so everything is like a stainless steel fabrication, stainless steel wire polishing. Holes are evenly spaced and smooth. A gentle pressure saves time and effort. Easy to handle, easy to clean, easy to damage, easy to deform. So I don't know.
It's like they got confused and forgot that they were like putting marketing material on it, or like the marketing material and the product warnings accidentally got mixed up when they were printing them on the box.
But okay, so I used it for several cloves. It doesn't actually feel flimsy to me at all. Like I had no concern about it breaking as I used it. But the thing is that. So there's two things. First of all, the way that these perforations are, it actually requires a considerable amount of force to get the garlic pressed through this perforated plate.
Like, yeah, you've got no lever working for you. You
exactly.
are just pressing garlic through some holes. Like
you might
imagine
as well.
Trying to press garlic through the small side of your box grater with your thumb. Like that's how much pressure you would need.
That's exactly what you're doing. And it's not comfortable and it's not easy. The second thing is that the amount of kind of waste garlic or garlic that's really difficult to retrieve after you've used this thing is much more significant than the basket press. You actually end up with like a kind of a whole like film of garlic paste that accumulates not just within
like in the holes
but also along the outer face. And you can kind of like scrape it away, and they give you a brush comes with this unit and stuff, but it's just like nowhere near as clean as or as high. It doesn't have anywhere near the yield that the basket press does.
Right, like what I would think would happen, like when I'm imagining the physics of it, is that like as you're pressing, like with the basket press, it's got a plunger that keeps the garlic from like forces the garlic through the holes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But in that rocking garlic, what is it called again?
On the box, it's a curved garlic press.
Right. With the curved garlic press, it seems to me what would happen is like the garlic is probably more likely to like spread out flat than it is to go through the holes directly, right?
Exactly,
so while
it.
You're pressing it, the garlic is squishing against your cutting board, and then just like a very like the very small amount of it that can't escape out to the sides actually goes through the holes. So like you wind up with like a whole clove of garlic that's just in the holes and barely any comes through the top or whatever.
Yeah. That was 100% my experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, seems like a bad idea.
Shale, 90s reference, curved garlic press, fit for the pit. Sorry, Canadian 90s reference. I don't know. Do you know what I'm talking about or no?
Not directly. I've heard it.
But. Oh, no. It's the CBC program called Street Sense. That was like, it was basically a consumer advocate program for teenagers.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Because I've heard people say that plenty of times, but I didn't really realize that that's where it came from. In fact, Nate Box used to say that all the time.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah. For the pit. And I'm 100% sure that he was referencing
that. That's where he got
Street
it from.
Sense. Yeah. Even though I'm probably sure that phrase exists outside of the context of that show, I'm 100% sure that's what he was referencing.
Yeah, we'll have to get him on the show and ask him about it.
Okay. I'm going to write that down.
Okay. Okay. So Judy sent us an email with a couple of links in it to news stories about people cutting their hand while bagel slicing.
Okay.
One from the LA Times. Mm-hmm. And one from a blog called New Yorker Bagels, by the looks of things.
Okay.
Let's see. When are these from? Doesn't say.
That's odd.
The LA Times one is from April 11th, 1995.
That makes sense to me. Because the way... Okay, so to the conversation that we're following up on is that we kind of made fun of bagel slicers, and Judy got back to us and said, well, actually, like, people cutting themselves while trying to slice bagels was a big problem. And
yeah, verbiage that she used was that emergency rooms were inundated with people who had lacerated their hands cutting bagels.
Right. So I talked to her before you and I were able to, before you and I talked about it. Because we were wondering if she was joking because of that word inundated. Like, we thought maybe she was making a joke. And I asked her, and she said she admitted that the word was a hyperbole, but she said no, she was being serious, and like that it was a problem. And the way, I partly from my conversation with her, but also because of my own personal experience with bagels, I was thinking about how bagels have been very important and commonly eaten in the like large urban Jewish communities like New York and Montreal and stuff like that in North America for 120, 150 years. But in places like, you know, where I spent a lot of my youth in Calgary, they were not very well known until the 1990s, until like the middle
of
the
bagel shops in the 90s in Calgary, though.
Good bagel shops in Calgary in the 90s?
Yeah.
Is that a joke?
No, it's real. What? Wayne's Bagels.
Wayne's Bagels.
Yeah.
Never heard of it.
Oh, Alan.
But okay.
Sorry.
So like, in the mid 90s, I was 10 years old and not very plugged into like the cool food scene in Calgary. But sometime.
Well, yeah, probably for the better, because you undoubtedly would have wound up in the emergency room if you had even heard of bagels.
No. Listen, Shail, what I'm trying to say is that sometime in the mid to late 90s, bagels became common grocery store items.
No, like, yeah, they blew up.
Someone marketed them to chain grocery stores, and all of the like the bakeries that they were developing within, like the in-house bakeries and grocery stores, started making them. And I now reflect that they were not very authentic, and they were not very much like the traditional bagels of New York and Montreal. They were just really like round bread.
Yeah.
But they were a craze. And like, 1 week my school sandwiches were on sliced white bread, and the next they were on bagels. And I think that for the most of the time that I was in high school, my bagged lunches, the sandwiches were put on grocery store bagels.
But how?
But
like, it's so dangerous, Alan.
It sounds dumb, but it's not inconceivable to me that all of a sudden there's this round bread product that is, you need to slice, that does not have a hinge. The dough is denser, certainly
in the case of grocery store bagels, usually not all that much denser, to be honest.
But I mean, compared to Wonder Bread, certainly it's denser,
I guess. Yeah, but nobody's slicing Wonder Bread, Alan.
Well, that's the whole point. That's what I mean. Like, people are used to soft pre-sliced bread. Well, I'm not joking. Like, no, I mean, you, like in the sub in like in the white,
I mean,
North
you're not
American
joking
suburbs.
But it is hilarious though.
That's true. Yeah. But the idea that this community is used to pre-sliced soft white bread and now has a denser bread that they need to slice themselves. It's not crazy to me that a lot of people cut themselves. Judy also mentioned to me in person, I don't know if this is in one of the emails, that there was like an emergency code possibly in New York for people... a numeric code that was used by hospital staff to say someone had a bagel related
to signify
injury.
That they had a bagel injury.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that,
I don't remember seeing that in either of these articles. I kind of skimmed them, so it's possible that I missed it, but yeah, no, I don't, I don't remember seeing it. I mean, yeah, sure. I'm sure it happens. I'm sure it happens way more than, like, I don't know, like, I'll bet over the course of the last 2 years, while everyone and their dog was learning how to cook sourdough in their kitchen, there were a lot more instances of people cutting their tips of their fingers with a bread knife trying to cut sourdough than there were people, you know, trying to slice bagels. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, like, it's not that I don't believe that it's a thing,
right?
Like, it's not that I don't believe that. I mean, yeah, one of these articles says that, basically lays out the case that it was the fifth most common kitchen injury that caused people to wind up in the hospital.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, you know, and probably a lot of injuries around the house happen in the kitchen. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's not totally insignificant, but, you know, like, it's also, people need things to write stories about. And, you know, it's not like these aren't the at least the links that she sent to us, like, you know, they're like lifestyle pieces based on interesting observations, not warnings about, right. you know, like how dangerous it is to purchase and slice bagels, mm-hmm. you know, like,
but it also,
but you could take it that way, you know, like you could take it in the way that you're like, oh my gosh, bagels actually are really dangerous, but, you know, like, they're not really that dangerous.
But I can now, I don't think that I can remember a specific infomercial for a bagel slicer, but I can picture it now, like the, are you tired of lacerating yourself while slicing
bagels? Yeah, are you tired of winding up in the ER every Sunday morning?
And there's kind of like a Monty Python spurting blood kind of gimmick going
yeah,
on.
And, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, if you had a bagel slicer, you could use it for more than just slicing bagels. Like, you could slice donuts in there.
Yeah, bagel slicer is just like a miniature guillotine, so...
That's right. You can use it for lots of stuff.
Yeah.
I also think it's kind of funny that, like, so this one article, the one from, I'll put both of these articles in the show notes. So, you know, people can go check them out. But this one article that's on NewYorkerBagels.com that doesn't have any date or any byline or anything. It's just like a blog post. Mm. It has a bunch of recommendations for how not to cut yourself if you're cutting bagels. And bagel slicer is like fourth on the list of five. So
oh, okay.
the main thing that they say, and this really actually, this rings true to me. You know, this to me seems like the actual heart of what we're of this discussion that we haven't really hit on yet. And that's that. A lot of people, when they're cutting bagels, they're cutting frozen bagels. And that is super dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Cutting frozen bagels is really dangerous. You shouldn't try to do that.
Mm-hmm. You should cut them before you freeze them.
Yeah. Or after you've thawed them. Those are the two options.
Got time for that. I'm not trying to flex or anything, but, like, literally, my job for a year was slicing bagels. For 1 year, I was a professional bagel slicer. So if you don't mind.
How many times did you cut yourself?
I did not sustain any significant cuts while working at June's Delicatessen.
I mean, it's anecdotal, but it's really pointing in the direction of what I think I'm trying to say here. And that's that if you're careful,
yeah,
you don't need a bagel slicer to slice a bagel.
But I was a professional, so...
Yeah, you had lots of practice at being careful. Maybe. Okay. Anyways, just don't cut them when they're frozen and you won't wind up in the emergency room. And if you really are scared about it, get a bagel slicer. But that's fourth on the list of five things that you should do to not cut yourself while slicing bagels.
If you're toasting your bagels, buy them fresh, cut them and then freeze them and then put them into the toaster frozen. That's what you should do.
Sure. I mean, that works. Or just eat them all before they go stale. I'm sorry, Alan, but that's a thing. Just eat them while they're fresh.
What's next, Shell?
Oh, man. Well, my childhood fish and chips shop apparently is still open under different management, which is, I think I kind of thought might have been the case. Anyways, my dad, Tony McDonald, he wrote in on Instagram.
Doherty's,
yeah. Doherty's Fish and Chips. Apparently it's still open. And then I asked him today if he's eaten there recently, and he said he ate there like a few months ago and it was still reasonably good. So I think he and my mom both think that it's sort of like had its ups and downs in terms of the quality, but said he ate there not that long ago and it was pretty decent. Also, my mom said that she thinks that the fish and chips were wrapped in like clean paper, some kind of, I don't think it was parchment, but something else, and then wrapped in newspaper on the outside.
Oh, okay.
So there was like a protective layer.
Like it was like blank newsprint and then actual newspaper on the outside or something.
Or something like that. Yeah. Or like, I don't think it was newsprint. She couldn't really, she said it was like some kind of tan colored paper, not like butcher paper and not like parchment. I don't know. I don't exactly remember what kind of paper that is, but.
We need to start like a, maybe just like food court Spruce Grove edition. We've talked about Spruce Grove restaurants a lot. And I know because Lisa's from Spruce Grove originally. So I know a little bit about the like something else restaurant and stuff like that. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Bing's.
Something else restaurant.
You know Bing's?
Yeah. Maybe we should have a Spruce Grove episode.
Okay. I'm going to write that
exclusive down Spruce Grove episode only for. Maybe if we have a Patreon someday or something. I don't know.
Okay, on...
It seems very neat.
Every time I drive... Oh, now I can't remember if it's on... I guess on 16A, when you drive through Spruce Grove, there's a Jack's Burger restaurant, but it's not Jack's Burger Shack. It's a different Jack's, right?
Yeah, it's a different Jack's, but it's a Jack's that a lot of people are aware of. Mm-hmm. It was kind of famous for a while.
Locally.
I know, yeah, not just locally. I know some people who like lived in Edmonton who weren't really like Spruce Groveites, who like used to get burgers from there on their way like back from
Jasper. Oh,
like if they're from Jasper probably or other places in the West, if they're coming through Stony Spruce Plain. Grove on what used to be like it used to be Highway 16. Mm. It used to be, I think, like that highway that kind of goes right through Spruce Grove. It's now
16A.
Well, it used to be the Trans-Canada Highway, I think.
No, the yellow, like Trans-Canada goes through Calgary, like the Yellowhead.
Right. Yeah, the Yellowhead.
Anyways, Jack's.
People used to stop at Jack's. I know people who didn't live in Spruce Grove, but who used to stop at like Jack's Drive-In all the time for burgers and for like they have like a crazy amount of like milkshake flavors and stuff too. So yeah.
Listen, Spruce Grove episode. We'll talk about all of them. Jack's. Bing's, something else, the Cossack Inn. Bing's. We'll invite, because Nevin and
you
Kara.
You really do know.
Of course I know. Nevin and Kara Fenske are from Spruce, aren't they?
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
so they'll be our special guests.
And we'll, that's a great
we'll
idea.
We'll get into it.
Okay.
Peters.
Maybe we should have my brothers on too. Something else restaurant.
Yeah.
Also used to be called... chicken steak and chocolate cake. I'm pretty sure chicken steak and chocolate cake. I think that's the right restaurant. It was something else before that too. I can't remember what it was before that.
Was that a joke?
No.
But it was something else before that.
It wasn't a joke, but it was hilarious.
So it was something else. And then it was chicken steak and chocolate cake. And then it was something else.
Sorry.
Okay.
It had a name that I can't remember. Then it was chicken steak and chocolate cake. Then it was something else. Sorry. I know that was very confusing.
This is just good TV show.
This is just good TV. And it just so happens that our actual topic for this episode is also follow-up.
Is it?
Yeah. Are you ready to go down that path, Alan?
Yeah.
So, listener Mike Forgey wrote in. He's a friend of both of ours. We worked with Mike. And he suggested a topic. So thanks, Mike. And the topic is like maybe a bit more of a deep dive on some of the like cuisines that we cooked when we cooked, I guess, like overseas or like away. Mm-hmm. And not just like, cause I know we both have kind of talked about, like I talked about some anecdotes of like things that, you know, happened while I was like cooking away at Noma and at Fiskabar and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think what Mike is interested in, like is more along the lines of like, you know, what food from those countries was like, you know, interesting to us while we were there. And did we learn how to cook like their actual, like, you know, because it's one thing to be cooking in a restaurant there. It's another thing to actually cook like the, I don't know, like the national cuisines of those places and right. actually like be exposed to their food culture and like, you know, what kind of things did we find inspiring? And then what sorts of things did we bring back? And then also additionally, like, are there other, you know, are there other sort of regional cuisines that we are excited about and would love to like either go to that region and cook them or that we're just like interested in trying to learn about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that's what we're going to talk about tonight, today, this morning, whenever you're listening to this. I always forget that
it's very late right now.
Podcast is like a time travel thing. What's that?
I said it's very late right now, actually, but yeah.
It's late for us, yeah. But you might be listening to this at like 8:30 a.m.
as you drive to work.
Yeah. Highly recommend.
Rebecca. Just kidding. I don't know. But it would just be cool.
There's a podcast called Hello Internet. Hello Internet. Yeah. Okay. That I don't know is probably canceled. I don't know. It's been on hiatus for a couple of years. Anyway, they call all of their listeners Tims.
Okay.
Anyway, so yeah, we're going to talk about, I'm going to talk a little bit about Danish cuisine because I cooked in Denmark. That's the only place that I've really cooked outside of Canada, like professionally. Mm. And then you probably have some stuff to say about Austrian cuisine. Is that right, Alan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how do you want to approach it?
For me, I had some like... to start, not just some dishes, but like some high level aspects of the cuisine that I took a lot from.
Cool.
That's really vague.
I mean, you know, it's vague when you say it like that, but I'm sure once we get into it.
Yeah. Like and then after those handful of categories and concepts, some specific dishes that have become part of my cooking at home and stuff. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Well, do you want to start then?
Sure.
Okay.
So the background is that I cooked in Austria, for a summer, and it was part of an exchange through Nate, through the, Northern Alberta Institute of Technology when I was in culinary school. And one year we hosted a group of Austrian, they were culinary students, but they were actually more broadly, like they were like hospitality and tourism students. So they learned culinary arts, but also a lot more. So we hosted them here in Edmonton. And then the following summer we went there and stayed with them and cooked in kitchens where their school was.
Cool. Where was that?
So that it was in and around a town called Semmering, which is about an hour outside of Vienna.
Okay.
And it's in the province of Niederösterreich and it was a tourism spot, but a tourism, region for Austrians primarily. Like it was not,
I see.
Like it was akin, I would say, to like the mountain regions in Alberta, like Kananaskis, where people from Calgary are going to ski and to mountain bike and stuff like that.
Right.
So, and it was an interesting place because it was like it was mountainous, but it was kind of like a border region where you didn't have like the wine production like you have around Vienna, but it wasn't really Alps either. So it was kind of like in between. And in a way it jived really well with the kind of food that we have here in Edmonton, which is why I think I took so much from it. But one of the biggest and most important and inspiring, influential, whatever parts of the food there was how they ate meat. When I went, I was already quite interested in meat cutting and a little bit interested in like sausage making and charcuterie and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But specifically, like at that time, one of the big buzzwords in food or buzz phrases was like nose to tail eating and right. Whole beast cookery or whatever. Like following famous restaurants, the way that movement showed itself in popular food culture was specific chefs and restaurants like Chris Cosentino and Fergus Henderson at St. John's, where they had these menus and these cookbooks that just called for really like from a North American grocery store perspective, really obscure cuts and like lots of offal and lots of organ meats and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so when that gets translated to restaurants in Edmonton, it was like, yeah, like people were putting like beef cheeks on the menu, or I remember seeing like pig skin fettuccine on a menu. Like it's like right. noodles made with pig skin, and these kind of like audacious and like kind of I don't think gimmicky is the right word, but like there'd be one item on the menu and it's like, yes, we're cooking nose to tail because we're using this obscure right. thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had been exposed to that. But then going to Austria and going to this region where they certainly had like their own tradition, and they're largely cooking for, they had their own regional tradition. And then they're also largely cooking for Austrians, even in the hotels and resorts. The fact was that like the nose to tail thing, it wasn't like it was like over the course of a week you would eat nose to tail. Right. It wasn't like you would go to a restaurant and eat a kooky thing once in a while. It was like you would go to a tavern and on the table you could see the entire pig, or eating meals in cafes and restaurants over the course of a couple of weeks, like you would eat the entire pig kind of thing.
Right.
And that was,
and it's like more in the vein of it, like less in the vein of it being a like dining. I mean, like, I hesitate to call it a fad because I don't know. I think that there is good intention behind the philosophy that sort of brought that into North American dining culture. Mm-hmm.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. You know, like, I don't want to be cynical about it because I do think that, you know, that it's like, it's a reaction to like factory farming, which I think, you know, is important. But what's interesting about it, I think, or like, you know, like what you're saying is that like there, it's not a fad there. It's right. just like how people eat because it makes more sense.
Yeah.
You know?
And in, like, yeah, it's good that you mentioned,
not that they don't have factory farmed animals there, I'm sure, but like,
right. Well, that's the thing. So you mentioned like the actual food supply chain. So there would be kinds of restaurants where you're eating that way because they literally are processing entire animals on site. But that would be a fairly traditional, rustic and not the norm like across the entire country. But then right. even in larger and more modern restaurants where they probably are getting meat from a distributor and not processing their own animals, like it's just so ingrained into the culture and tradition that they would eat that way and procure their food that way anyways.
Right.
Anyway, so it was eye-opening in terms of the higher level like what it means to eat the whole animal, but also like seeing the specific techniques and preparations that you need to make to actually utilize everything. Like I feel like what I had been exposed to was like Cosentino on Iron Chef. And it's like, yeah, you serve people chicken heads and they suck the brains out of the chicken head, trying to misrepresent, like I have a lot of respect for Chris Cosentino, but that was kind of the like, the gaudy side of it on television. But to see the actual preparations, like how you render fat, how you collect the byproducts of rendered fat, what you do with those byproducts, how you eat them and make them delicious, or like what to do. They eat it like a crazy amount of just like cold cuts and sliced meats. And like, what do you do with all the trim from your ham and your roast beef and stuff like that? And preparations with organ meat too. Like, I didn't grow up eating that at all. I know that like my grandparents made head cheese and stuff, but my great grandparents made head cheese, but I didn't really grow up eating that. But seeing that like and tasting it and trying to figure out how they made it, so beautiful and delicious. Like it had a huge influence on me, especially because like I mentioned, I had been interested in meat cutting before going there. And when I came back, like that's all the meat that we brought into our home was, from sides and quarters of whole animals. And, I tried to put some of the stuff that I learned into practice. And that was probably
to the extent that you pull out your meat grinder, like on an almost weekly basis. Yeah. And
totally.
I mean, I've been the beneficiary of a lot of the knowledge that you've brought back. So that's great. I consider myself lucky.
What did I teach you?
Not just stuff that I learned from you, but just like eating your charcuterie.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think I learned a lot about sausage making from you. And also from Will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Will is like the main butcher at Muley's Meats. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a
font. He's a font of wisdom.
He's a font of knowledge. Yeah. And so like, was that what you expected when you went? Like, did you,
No.
It was surprising to you?
So no. That all took me completely by surprise. We had, as a requirement of being accepted into the exchange, I had researched and written a paper on Austrian cuisine, and I was like, "Oh yeah, I know, I know it now." Wiener Schnitzel and Tafelspitz and Strudel and whatever else.
Soccer tort.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then. I was really lucky, or I think it was really great for me that the place we were and the people who were hosting us, like it was a little bit more, I think I could have gone to Austria and had that kind of cosmopolitan view and like, yeah, these are the national dishes and like, that's what you get served in Vienna. But to be somewhere a little bit more rural and with a little bit more regional character, I thought I knew a little bit about Austrian cuisine, but then to go to some of the taverns in the small towns and have these spreads put before us, like I didn't know what anything was. But we had one of the Austrian chaperones who grew up in the community who just like understood it. And like, I asked her probably 300 questions over the course of an evening and took notes. And so like to give you an idea of some of the specifics, it sounds like Mike was interested in like what the cuisines really are. At these rural taverns where they're cooking, like a lot of it's cold food And in this region, I mentioned it's not a wine region. It was a cider region, like a little bit higher elevation. So you'd go to these taverns and be served dry cider, like hard cider, and lots of cured pork. So the kind of one of the main, the most important things was these pork roasts, but they were cured like ham. But they would separate, they would pay the kind of attention that we would to beef and different muscles on a cow, to pork. So like in North America, a hind leg of a pig is ham. It gets cut in a few different places with a bandsaw, but like it's ham. That's what it is. But in Austria, they would distinguish, like, this isn't, these aren't the words they would use, but they would distinguish between the inside round and outside round and sirloin tip, just like we would on beef. So all of these muscles would be separated and cured separately and sliced and presented separately and served by the name of that muscle. And so that alone was like mind blowing to me because like, we just don't do that in North America. And it's,
well, they also don't really do that in like Italy and Spain. And, you know, like
they do, like, that's an interesting point. Like the, certainly every pork eating community has different ways of dividing up the pig.
And I'm sure in Austria there are regions and there probably are preparations that are whole cured pig legs as well, right? But
yes, absolutely. This is, someone can correct me, I'm speculating, but I'm actually inclined to think that a lot of those are influenced, like those are influenced by Italy and kind of how in vogue Italian preparations are. I'm sure they still, like, I'm sure that yes, there are whole leg preparations traditional to Austria, but I think that like if you're thinking of prosciutto and like that style of like cured and air dried,
like cured,
like I think that's definitely more of a Mediterranean tradition. It's definitely part of the Tyrol region of Austria, but I think other, like the Alpine regions and other parts of Austria, I don't think that's as traditional. It's more like the like cured and cooked style, like more like ham, like what we would just call ham. But I might be, I'm kind of out of my depth, I guess, but anyway, so just to see, the kind of attention that they paid just to the way they cut the pig, not something that you would see in like the North American tradition. And then all of these delicious spreads, like just meant to be put onto bread, that are actually like, you wouldn't know this by looking at them and eating them, but they're all byproducts. They're all like, it's like we're slicing all of this cold cured pork. And then there's always that last little bit that can't get through the slicer. So we're going to grind that up and we're going to mix it with like fat and mustard and we'll make a spread out of it. Or we've actually talked about this, I think, in a previous conversation, like rendering fat, you end up with all this connective tissue that doesn't, that after you've pressed out the fat. So you just like fry it. So it's crispy. And then you use like bacon bits. And so that kind of meal served to me really, it opened my mind, but also like having that chaperone and that kind of like Virgil kind of figure, like guiding me through it, like actually taught me a lot of technique too.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you eat any meals like in, like you must have like eaten home cooked meals?
Yeah, a few. Like when I stayed there, we were actually living in the dormitories in that hospitality school. So like our daily breakfast at least was like from effectively a cafeteria. But I was able to stay, like I stayed with the student who had lived with Lisa and I in Edmonton the summer previous. I did go and spend a couple nights with his family. And so, yeah, did get some home cooked meals. Yeah.
But you don't want to talk about them.
Oh, well, okay. So
was it any different from the food that you got? I guess like, yeah, maybe I should have been more specific, but like, did you, yeah, like was your exposure to like food that people would eat like in their house, is that like different from the food that you would get at the tavern or like?
Well, interestingly, I would say that the difference between home food and restaurant food is much more pronounced in North America than it was in my experience right. in Austria. So like, for instance, whether it was in a hotel or, well, I don't know if this is a good, if this is the most illustrative, but whether it was in a hotel or a B&B or somebody's home or a cafeteria, like breakfast there is cold cuts and cheese and bread and coffee.
Right.
Like they're not doing eggs and hash browns. That's for sure.
And the eggs are so good.
Well, this was, yeah. One of the incidents that made me first understand what is meant by the term continental breakfast. Like when we first hosted the Austrian student at our home in Edmonton, like one morning, I don't know, like Lisa started work late or something. And so I made eggs and hash browns and served it to the student. And like, he took a few bites and like, couldn't do it. And he just said, it tastes fine, but potatoes for breakfast, I just can't or something. Like his whole life had been like cold, like had been ham and salami.
It's not that big a deal. You can have potatoes for breakfast. It's not the end of the world.
It was very, well, people are,
this was a culinary student.
So yeah, like a hospitality.
Broaden your horizons a little bit.
Well,
potatoes
for
breakfast.
I think that, okay,
I just cannot do
but
it.
But listen, think about like you, like Shale, you as a, you, he wasn't this young, but say you're like 10 years old and like,
This kid was 10.
No, I just said he's not.
Okay.
And a Japanese family tries to feed you like rice and pickles for breakfast. You would think it's very strange, I think.
Yeah, if I was 10.
Okay. But if
maybe.
What if you were
16? What if I was a culinary student and I went to Japan and stayed with a family and they served me natto for breakfast and rice? Mm-hmm. I would be like, this is crazy and I'm fascinated by it.
Well, that's not what happened.
Yeah, which is what I'm saying is unfortunate. Are you still in touch with that guy?
We're still like kind of like modern social media. Like I see what he's doing and he sees
you
what
see
I'm
his posts
doing.
Sometimes and stuff. Yeah, yeah.
And we like stuff that we do, but that's not a real, that I guess, yeah. I guess the answer is
no. Do you scan
no.
his Instagram to see if he's having potatoes for breakfast now?
Oh, I hear it's all the rage in Austria now.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's just the Americanization of, or the globalization of food.
I mean, potatoes for dessert.
Oh man.
Maybe not the best, but like every other meal.
11 Madison Park did a potato ice cream, but that was with a caviar course, not a dessert.
Right.
Anyways, what we were talking about was, so that's breakfast, a true continental breakfast, cold cuts and cheese and bread and coffee. And then lunch was like the principal meal of the
day. That's not continental breakfast that most of the hotels.
Oh, you won't let me just say. We can't say any, we can't get on to anything. You mean because it's not like Eggos and Kellogg's cornflakes and stuff? Is that what you mean? Or?
Yeah, it's not like three kinds of boxes of cereal and then like a basket full of like
frozen
oranges that are dry and then like, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll let you speak. Go ahead. Continental breakfast, Alan.
But that was a because I didn't know what continental breakfast meant. Like I didn't understand. I didn't equate continental with like, oh yeah, continental Europe. Like it's in contrast to the English breakfast, which is eggs and potatoes and fried meat and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so lunch was the principal meal. So whether it's at home or in a restaurant, it was like you could expect that there would be soup and then meat and then a dessert, which was cool. And then I guess dinner depended whether you were going out or eating in. I think that at home dinner tended to be more like you revert to the like whatever, yeah, cold cuts and bread or whatever. But for special occasions or if you're eating out, then it was more elaborate and more like lunch. But
yeah, right.
I'm sorry, Alan.
But.
And would they have potatoes at either lunch or dinner?
I'm pretty sure that the Austrians eat potatoes. Yeah.
Eat potatoes. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't exactly
know a whole lot about it, but all right. Yeah. I think it's really cool that you got to like go to, a more sort of out of the, like, I guess rural probably isn't the right way of putting it, but like, you know, kind of more out of the way spot where, you know, you had more exposure to what actual Austrian food is like and not necessarily just like what you would get in Vienna or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. I mean, I spent quite a bit of time in Denmark, but most of it, like the vast majority, was in Copenhagen. So mm-hmm. I don't have a whole lot of exposure to like Danish food outside of Copenhagen.
But you were put up with some Danes, right? You said that when you finally got a proper room, you were like out of the hostel and you were in with some of the other folks who worked at Noma, right?
Well, yeah. So when I was at Noma, I was for like the, after the first 2 weeks or after the first week and a half, I was living with some cooks from Noma. We didn't really, I think we made one meal at home or something. Mm-hmm. And actually they were all of the cooks that I stayed with, none of them were Danish.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah. They were all, none of them were stagiaires either, I don't believe. Mm-hmm. They were all actually like employed at Noma, mm-hmm. but yeah, none of them were, one of them was Mexican. One of them was Belgian. One of them was Portuguese, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. There was four of us. Yeah, and we like never really cooked at home. I think we cooked one meal like near the end of when I was staying there. I think like when Noma closed for the Christmas break or something was like at the end of my stay. And then I think we made like a meal at home and everybody kind of pitched in.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Generally, there was just no time to like prepare any food there,
right?
Like besides grabbing a piece of fruit or whatever. But I did. Then I worked at Fiskebar for whatever it was, like 9 months or 10 months. I can't remember. And pretty much the whole time that I was working at Fiskebar, I was renting a room from this woman named Lisbeth. So I was just like renting a room in her apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a great host. We didn't like cook at home a whole lot. My family came and stayed with me while I was in Denmark and they stayed in her living room. Like it was,
oh, is there?
Like, well, they stayed in my room and I stayed in the living room. But yeah, she basically like opened up her apartment to us, which was like, awesome.
You mean your mom and dad?
Yeah, yeah, my mom and dad and my sister.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and we all ate at Noma. I have pictures of like me and my mom and dad and Bryn all eating at Noma. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was awesome. But yeah, I cooked for her a couple of times and she cooked for me a few times, but there wasn't a whole lot of like eating at home. Really, I was like working a lot. And then on my non-work days, I was like going out and exploring the city for food or getting out of the city and going like, and like trying to go to other places, like just kind of within like half a day's train ride of Copenhagen or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I was just sort of like exploring on my own and I didn't really have a guide to like show me where, you know, like authentic Danish, you know, food places were that were outside the city or anything like that.
Right, yeah.
My friend Casper like took me to a few places sort of like more in the neighborhood where he lived.
Mm-hmm.
But the food in he sort of like lived in a suburban neighborhood that was like in the south edge of Copenhagen, mm-hmm. I believe. But I mean, the food wasn't that much different from like in the city or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty similar types of things. But yeah, there is a lot of like traditional Danish cuisine. And I ate a lot of that stuff while I was there and didn't have much occasion to cook tons of it. Although like, because I was working in Noma and because I was working in Fiskebar, like a lot of the food that they were doing in those restaurants was inspired by traditional Danish cuisine. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a modern take or whatever. And so I was like cooking components that would be like that you would find in like traditional Danish restaurants. But like the traditional Danish stuff is like, oh man, I don't want to pronounce any Danish words. I'm so bad at it. But there's like this Danish open-faced sandwich culture thing that is probably their most famous kind of traditional food. And it's called smørbrød, which I think means like, I don't know, spread and bread or something.
Yeah.
And you go to a restaurant and they just have like 40 or 50 variations that you can order, and you just order in small plates, and you can order like five or six different types, and they bring you like little open face sandwiches on this like really amazing sort of like dense rye bread that's made out of like sprouted grain. And there's just like the amount of like different toppings that you can get on them are endless. There's like a lot of pretty traditional ones. There's like shrimp salad with dill is like really traditional. There's, oh man, like there's just so many. I wouldn't even know where to start. Like, you know, there's lots of like pork related ones. Like, but yeah.
And ones so that like, are that's sort like tartare, of like tartare, right? I think I've seen ones that have raw minced beef on them.
Yeah. There are ones that are like tartare. And there's ones with like cold cuts, and there's ones with like different types of salads, and like, I can't even remember them all.
And you eat them with your hands or knife and fork? However you please.
However you please, I think. Yeah, knife and fork are provided. You can definitely, in some cases, pick them up and eat them, though. Yeah, and like in most cases, like most restaurants that are doing those, like it is pretty traditional. And so most of the restaurants that are doing that, unless it's like straight up for tourists or something, like really make an effort to make them good. Like, you know, it's like they really take pride in like the traditional aspect of like presenting all of these different options and making them all delicious. And yeah, most of the times when I went out and had that, it was like pretty amazing. So there's so many different options that you can order, and they're usually also delicious.
Was there anything that you ate there? Actually, just keeping it to like ingredients or ways to use ingredients. Was there anything you saw there where you're like, oh, I could do that at home?
You mean with smørbrød specifically or just Danish?
Yeah, with anything.
Yeah, well, like the biggest one for me that was like super eye-opening and that I don't do very often even now, and it's, you know, partially because it's like hard to get the right ingredient, but it's also like a tricky preparation, and I don't have like, I only got to sort of like make it alongside people like once or twice while I was over there. But like there's this like crispy pork roast that they like with pork roast with crispy skin that they do for like special occasions. And that is also usually available like on open face sandwiches. You get this like super crispy, like rind. That's just like, it's not in any way like chewy or gets stuck in your teeth. It's just like perfectly crispy. And then the pork is just like beautiful and juicy and, you know, perfectly cooked. I can't remember the Danish name for it. I can't remember. But yeah, it's a very specific way of like roasting a pork loin. And that for sure is something that like, you know, I can't ever erase from my mind and that like I think about all the time and that I want to just sort of bring back with me, you know, like and, that was the biggest thing I think.
And were you able to,
I wanted to bring back.
Were you able to like you got the technique, like you know how they did it or?
Yeah, I have like a really good idea of how they do it. It's tough. Like you need a really hot oven. You need like a pretty good accurate oven to do it properly. Mm-hmm. And I haven't really been able to effectively do it here very, very well. So mm-hmm. it's kind of sad. Although I do have like a convection oven in my actual home kitchen now. And I probably should try again, mm-hmm. take another crack at it. But it's also kind of hard to get like a good like pork loin with skin on here.
Do you mean like a good quality?
Yeah.
Like high quality.
And like, yeah. Yeah. And like, you know, where the, yeah. And just like, it's, you can't just go to the grocery store and buy a pork loin with skin on. Like,
yeah, that's
you know,
true. Yeah.
You can, and like most butchers, you can't even do that. You have to request it ahead of time mm-hmm. or something, mm-hmm. you know, make me a pork loin roast and leave the skin on.
Right.
You know, like, yeah. It's like a special request kind of thing. It's not like something that you can just go get. I mean, when you're bringing in whole sides, I mean, you can do whatever you want with your pork loin, Alan, but I
although it is interesting to note, like when I found that when I buy pork by the side, typically that means coming from smaller packing houses. And
right.
oftentimes a lot of the skin on those sides of pork is not good for cooking with anymore because it's been
right.
either because it's dried, like because it's dried out, or because it still has bristles in it. And so
right.
when you see videos of like I mentioned Fergus Henderson, in the UK, like working with whatever pig's heads or whatever. And like, they have like beautiful, like pale, soft skin and no bristles. That's not been my experience from getting pork that's processed at small abattoirs in Alberta.
Right.
But anyways, that, and I, that's probably another conversation, but
yeah, we can talk about it offline because maybe you can help point me in the direction of where I could get an appropriate roast for mm-hmm. it. But.
One of the things that was in, like, again, thinking back to like what the kinds of trends and way people were talking about food here when I went to Austria, like it was kind of at the crest of the local food move. Like, I mean, I'm not saying that has disappeared, but like the 100-mile diet specifically and that kind of idea of food. And so there were lots of restaurants here that were a part of that. The way that it manifested itself on the menus was typically like you would put the name of like either your protein or your vegetables, like would be coming from local farms and sorry, your protein or yeah. your vegetables or both would be coming from local farms and you'd put the name of the farm on the menu. That's kind of how it happened here. And I think there were some foraged items showing up, but by and large, it was like you're supporting local farmers. You put the farmer's name or the farm name on the menu. There was a lot that I saw in Austria that expanded on that, especially there with wild and foraged ingredients, and
right.
which I knew of, like because I had friends who were hunters and foragers. But like mostly, I thought of like places like Noma.
Mm-hmm.
Like in terms of using wild ingredients, like really obscure things. But like one place in particular that I worked in Austria, it was called Los Haus, and it was in a village called Kreuzberg, which was just outside of that Semmering town that I mentioned. They were using, like they were primarily catering to locals, I would say.
Right.
But they were using a lot of wild ingredients and wild ingredients that I had never even considered using, like dandelions.
Oh, yeah.
Like they would harvest dandelion flower heads and make syrup, like to make sodas out of them. I was working there in May. And so there was wild wild strawberries and elderflowers and May deer, like fawns, basically, like very young deer that they would hunt in May, which you can't do in Canada because we're not allowed to hunt. We can only hunt in the fall. And also you can't serve, as we've discussed before, you can't serve true wild game in restaurants in Canada for the most part. Right. But you can in Austria. And the other thing that did translate quite well to hear was they would harvest the little needle buds from spruce trees. That they're just starting to open in May, and they would make syrups.
Yeah, that's the thing here too, sort of.
I didn't know that at the time. I think there's certainly people in our part of the world who have done that forever. But outside of Austria, the first time I heard about it was actually at Noma. But that Los House place that I worked, they would harvest them there, and they would make a syrup out of it, and then flavor some of the sauces that they served with game with those spruce tips. But even in there, we ate at a Michelin-starred restaurant in Vienna called Steirerec. And they had a dessert course with strawberries, like strawberries and meringue and these spruce tips, sprinkled raw onto them. Cause they have a like really interesting, like kind of like, yes, they're sprucey, but they're kind of like citrusy and sour. But that's a part that's like a very traditional ingredient there for that time of year. So there was a lot of like, ingredient wise, a lot of things that I could take back home with me and use.
Yeah, there was a bunch of stuff like that for me in Denmark too. Ingredients that like are pretty prevalent or pretty popular in like common usage over there that are available here that just aren't in as common a usage or whatever. Mm-hmm. And a few that like exist here, but like just nobody's ever heard of. Like one of the big ones is, elderflower is a big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which isn't as available over here, I guess.
Yeah. That's
yeah.
Like they do grow here. For instance, like I have one in my front yard, like a very small, like it's called a golden elderberry, but it was sold to me as being hardy to our winters, but it experiences significant dieback every year. So it's only like, I planted it and it was 2 feet tall and like it's 6 years old and now it's 3 feet tall. So I don't know if it's just like that varietal or what, but like, I know there are elderberries growing in Edmonton, but I'm not convinced that they're truly up to the task of living
here. Yeah. They might need to be a little closer to the coast.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just a little more mild. I don't know. Like, they grow everywhere in Denmark, but
there's
a lot of coastline in Denmark.
The red elder, like in, I don't know if they're native, but like in the Edmonton River Valley, there's red elderberries everywhere. Like they're absolutely everywhere, but I don't think that they're edible. They're certainly not the same.
Oh, okay.
They're not the same plant as the black elderberries that they have in Europe. But anyways, it's a great flavor though.
Yeah, it is a great flavor. Yeah. Another big one from Denmark that I had never heard of before I went, and then when I got back, I realized that it is also kind of available here, sea buckthorn.
Oh, yeah. It's totally available here.
Yeah.
A lot of city parks have them.
But like nobody really has heard of it, and people that have heard of it over here, like lots of people call it sea berry or something instead.
Well, you know what? I think as far as I'm concerned, the common name for it is sea buckthorn. The first time I heard of it called Seaberry was actually when Strathcona Distillery opened and they have their kind of flagship gin. And they said that it was made with seaberries. And I was like, what the heck is a seaberry? And I'm pretty sure it's just like, it's kind of like how Haskap became Honeyberry and sea buckthorn becomes Seaberry.
It's just like a marketing thing.
It doesn't have the word buck and thorn in it, so it sounds better.
Right. I guess
that's how I see it. It's a great gin, though. I'm not trying to despair. I'm not trying to throw shade on Strathcona. I love their stuff.
Well, and I don't know if they made up that name for it. Yeah. For all I know, the person that they got it from called it Seabuck.
That's true. Yeah. That's just the first time that I heard of it. But Seabuck Thorn is crazy. It's like if, again, like a citrus, an actual like vibrant, bright, a citrus flavor, which you don't usually think that our part of the world can produce. But yeah, to me, it like tastes like lemons and oranges.
Yeah, it has a very bright, very citrusy flavor. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, it's more on the sour end, of citrus, but yeah, man. Yeah, it's great. And then another thing that like, seems like a common thing, but like mostly here just gets used in like baking and stuff is buttermilk. Like they use buttermilk for lots of things over there.
Yeah.
Like as a flavoring ingredient for sauces and dishes. And, you know, here we don't use it that way really. We use it in biscuits and in pancakes and in, you know, cornbread, like it's in baking. It's in lots of baking recipes, but you know, in most like traditional North American preparations and stuff, it's not like an actual like flavor component. Mm-hmm. And so that was really inspiring. Like, you know, just as an ingredient, it's like this, you know, like it's got its own characteristics and its own texture and its own set of flavors. And it works really well if you pair it with the right things. And yeah, that was a big one for me too. Just being like, oh yeah, buttermilk. Mm-hmm. You can use that for lots of stuff, you know.
Like seafood, which I think we've talked about. My obsession with buttermilk, which we've talked about on the show before.
Exactly. Those are like and like the rye bread thing too. Like you just can't really get the same style of like really dense like sprouted grain breads here. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like I think before I went, I wouldn't have necessarily thought that I would be a big fan of that. But then after making it and eating it, and it can be really amazing.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think I've seen a place that makes that stuff. So like, for instance, they eat a lot of rye bread in Austria, but it's not, I don't think it's remotely what you're describing. Like the stuff in Austria is more like what would be sold here as light rye or medium rye. And it's like fairly conventional bread with a dash of rye in it. But you mean the ones that like at the Italian Center here, they sell like the shelf stable rye breads that are very, very dense, but still moist, and made with sprouted grains. You can slice them very, very thinly. And they'll still be,
it's more like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They sell that at the Italian Center.
Yeah, like I don't know if it's the same quality as what you're talking about, but at the Italian Center and at K&K Foodliner, they have like shelf stable ones that that are there all the time.
That's interesting. Yeah.
But yeah, it's not something that's like used very much outside of that kind of niche,
I mean, it's basically made out of like sprouted rye grains and like other grains too. Like I think there's like other wheat. I'm not going to bother pulling up my recipe for it right now, but yeah, this is like mostly sprouted grains held together by like the like starch that comes out of the grains when they start to sprout.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Basically. Mm. Yeah. So yeah, like I don't know. And it's interesting. I don't think like now when I look at the stuff that I cook every day, I don't feel like it's heavily influenced necessarily by my time in Denmark. Mm-hmm. And I've had to write all kinds of different menus. I try to like sneak in some of those flavors. If I get to be creative when I'm making a menu, those things still inspire me and they're definitely still a signature for me. Mm-hmm. And so I do like wind up using things like buttermilk in ways that they wouldn't necessarily be, that it wouldn't necessarily be used and things like that. Like I definitely have brought that inspiration forward with me, but I wouldn't say it's like my day to day necessarily, but definitely in terms of my cooking career, it brought a lot of influence and like gave me some, gave me a bunch of ways to feel confident about having my own style, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Of cooking or something. Are there other places, Alan, that you would love to go cook if you had the opportunity?
Sure. Yeah. Like,
what's at the top of your list?
To be honest, right now, I want to go to Newfoundland and cook.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I want to go and cook at one of Jeremy Charles's restaurants. That's where I would want to go.
Cool. That's like so close to home yet so far away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I feel like I actually don't know very much about the restaurants I'm talking about, but like Raymond's in St. John's, and I don't fully understand how Jeremy Charles is associated with this other place, but the Fogo Island Inn, F-O-G-O, Fogo okay. Island Inn. I feel like places like that have kind of in the same way that Noma became a poster child for New Nordic and Copenhagen and stuff. Like when you look at this, the plates and the stories that those places in Newfoundland are telling, it's like just as compelling and like has a very unique style and tradition. And if I mean, I one day, like, I want to go to Japan and I want to go to Korea and I want to go back to Italy and stuff like that. But like, if you ask me, like, if I could go somewhere tomorrow where I think that I could like be inspired and learn something that I could bring home with me, even though it's a very different place mm-hmm. than where we live, that's where I'd want to go to cook.
That's interesting. I haven't even heard of those places, so it seems like that's another topic of conversation that we should have sometime, because mm-hmm. I'd love to pick your brain about it.
Sure.
It sounds like I have some research to do too.
But a more like I do feel like my entire cooking career, like obviously I've been exposed to like different so-called international cuisines or whatever, but like
right,
yeah. Like I do feel like I've been so Eurocentric in almost all of the cooking and reading and stuff that I've done. I've kind of dipped my toe into Korean food only because I was like really interested in kimchi, and made it in such large quantities. I've like done some reading on it, and like we try to cook some Korean stuff at home sometimes. That's something that I feel like maybe in my 40s or something, like I'm like, there's going to be like a period of my life where I like go headlong into.
Alan, that's coming up pretty quick. I feel like
I just have a friend who his 37th birthday was today. So I was thinking about that. Like I do feel like at some point, like I need to go to Japan. I need to go to Korea. I need to go to Vietnam. China is very scary to me and from a culinary sense. Like it seems so daunting.
Well, yeah,
so daunting. Yeah. Like it's like so many regions so much tradition. Yeah. So, but I feel like it's an inevitability that like I will get into that. I have not yet really. I love going to Korean and Japanese and Chinese restaurants in Edmonton, but I don't really know that much about the food, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's kind of what I was going to say is like, I have some exposure to it, and like I've always been really interested in Korean, Japanese, Chinese, and Vietnamese food, like and Thai to some extent as well, but
and Indonesian and like, Filipino, like yeah, yeah,
yeah. But like you know, Japanese especially and Vietnamese especially for me, mm-hmm. I've just been like really, you know, in terms of like wanting to understand the food and like wanting to try as much of it as possible and wanting to be able to cook it, I've taken every opportunity that I sort of have come across to like broaden my horizons in that way. Like anytime I'm working with someone who has, you know, cooked in Japan or made Japanese dishes, I'm always picking their brain about it or, mm-hmm. You know, trying to get them to show me. But yeah, like I think, you know, there's a big difference between, you know, having someone show you a dish secondhand and going somewhere and cooking the same food for, you know, a couple months on end and doing the same thing every day and really getting your hands into it.
Yeah.
I got like, I sort of got the tip of the iceberg of that with Vietnamese food.
Right. Yeah.
Working with Linda Ha's mom and like, you know, having her show and, you know, working in that restaurant for several months and doing the same stuff every day, but it was still, you know, a pretty limited subset of things that we were doing.
Right. Yeah.
And we were kind of like limiting it on purpose so that A, I could get myself up to speed, and also so that we, you know, had like a pretty select set of offerings for, you know, the customer base that we were trying to grow. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, that was good and I got a lot of good experience from that, but I mean, I would really, you know, love to go cook in a Vietnamese restaurant, like an actual Vietnamese restaurant in Vietnam at some point.
Even in Edmonton. Like, I've thought about that. Like,
I mean, potentially, yeah. I think it would kind of be a different experience in Edmonton.
Oh,
like, I wouldn't I wouldn't necessarily have my pick of like things that I got to, you know, experience or dishes that I, you know, am fascinated with that I would love to learn how to prepare. Like, mm-hmm. Like one thing that we talked about doing lots, that Linda and I talked about doing lots, was bunseo,
yeah.
Which is like, it's like a kind of crepe pancake kind of thing. And you have a spread and you'd like put a, you know, you have lots of different things that you can stuff it with or whatever. And
then you eat,
but we never really got around to doing it. And I don't think that there's a place that I could go in Edmonton and learn how to make that, you know,
like, there is. It's I specifically asked someone who knows Vietnamese food, not Tao Bay. What's the shoot? Sorry. Anyways, I know the dish you're talking about. You're right. It's not okay. Typically on Vietnamese restaurant menus in Edmonton.
Or if they have it, it's like on a special day or something.
Yeah. Or like Pho Boy had it on their menu, but it was not traditional. It was like a big plate sized version of it. It wasn't like the little ones that you could fold up and eat in lettuce. I can't remember the name of the, do you know where Pegalac is on 97th?
Yeah.
There's another Vietnamese place just like a block or two south of there. And I can't remember the name of it, but they had Bon Xiao right at, like on their sign.
So it's like a big deal for them. Oh, well, yeah, maybe I should wander down there and hit them up one day.
You guys hiring?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think like, that's sort of it for me with Japanese food too. It's like sort of like, I've prepared a fair few Japanese dishes, but I feel like, I don't know. Yeah, you can't really get a handle on what it's like to prepare Japanese food without working in a Japanese restaurant, mm-hmm. you know, like, so, you know, and I want to do deep dives on things that are not just like, you know, not just sushi or something, you know? Yeah.
Do you know any cooks who like have worked in China or?
Talib.
Oh, of course, yeah. Oh, yes.
Talib is the chef at a really amazing fine dining restaurant in Beijing, I think.
Is it? I follow him on Instagram, and I, as recently as today, saw some of the beautiful plates he makes. I don't like, it's called the restaurant as it shows up on Instagram is Reefer, R-E-F-E-R, but I don't know if that's how you say it. I don't know where it is, or I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Anyways, he's cooking in China.
That's right.
I've only spoken to him once since he was over there, and it was only very briefly. He just like came into district one day after he had like, he was back here visiting his family, I guess, or whatever. So I haven't had much occasion to speak to him about it. And yeah, I don't really talk to him on social media very much, but yeah. That's pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. And I know like when I was in Denmark, there were a lot of Chinese chefs who were coming to Denmark to try to recruit Danish chefs to come work in China.
Oh, okay.
And like, a few chefs that I like, one of the chef from Fiskebar wound up going and working in China, and like some other people that he knew also got opportunities to go and like open restaurants in China. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but I don't really know a lot of people who I have a ton of experience like cooking alongside who have gone and worked in Chinese restaurants, and yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And same for Japan. I don't really know anybody who's worked in Japan, and then I worked with them. Mm-hmm. When I was in Europe, I met a fair few Japanese cooks. And I mean, I know lots of people who are in the industry who have been to Japan and eaten a lot of food there and stuff, but
right.
I don't know. I think it's pretty hard to like go over there and work in a restaurant. I don't know.
Like if you don't speak Japanese, you mean?
Yeah. And from potentially from a visa perspective as well.
I'm
not quite sure how it works, mm-hmm. but yeah.
Yeah. That's actually why I asked. Cause it's also just not really the sphere that I'm a part of. Like I'm not the most of the folks I've not worked in a Michelin starred restaurant, for instance. So I'm not like
right.
part of the jet set crowd, Shale. But
right. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm obviously there's people in Edmonton who have that experience, I think, but I don't know them.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm sure there must be cooks cooking in Edmonton who worked in Japan. Especially I'm sure there's Japanese chefs who work in Japanese restaurants yeah. here who worked in Japan.
And probably on the hotel scene, right? Like I think that there's probably much more yeah. interchange.
Yeah, probably. Anyways, I like your answer better. Your answer is much more original.
What did I say?
Newfoundland.
Oh. Sure. Yeah. Although I would love, there yeah. is also, there's an Indian restaurant literally one block from my house called Coriander Cuisine. And before the pandemic, I was dead set on it. Like it's great. The food is great. I wanted to, and they have a ridiculously large menu, but I wanted to eat everything on the menu and do a little, maybe like a blog or I don't know, an Instagram feed or something about every single dish and try and learn a little bit about the history and the technique and stuff like that. But then cool. the pandemic.
Would they be willing to like talk to you about each dish at the table and stuff like that?
The few times that I've been there, the chef is more than willing to come and talk to you, answer any questions.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Oh, maybe we can have an episode about sure. that. If you go and do that research, maybe we can
oh, have great. A chat after about I do all the work. Oh boy. Just kidding.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe we can go together.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sudeby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.